This is the Actual Fluency Podcast, helping you become a better language learner by providing motivating weekly inspiration, as well as top tips and tricks from expert guests. And now, your host, Chris Broholm.
We're back, and on the show today, I'm happy to have Moshe Sherrison, who is the author of The Easy Schmeezy Guide to Yiddish, which you can find on Amazon. And Moshe, why don't we just get into it and tell your story of how you got into actually teaching other people Yiddish, and what's your background with this?
Okay, great question. Chris, it's awesome to be here. I am so excited. And, you know, we better make sure that we cut this thing down to, you know, not longer than 3 hours. Because I know, you know, once you get two language lovers talking, we could just go on forever.
Yes.
So at like the 3 hour point, just give me a little elbow, you know, poke me or something.
Right.
So I'll tell you, I'm 32 years old, and I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, in the USA. And I went to Hebrew school from age like, you know, 4 to 10th grade. And, you know, it was like a Jewish day school. The first half of the morning was Judaic studies, studying the Torah, the Bible, and Jewish law. And the second half of the day was secular studies. So it was very difficult as a kid, you know, having a dual curriculum. And I had a very hard time with the second language. You know, the studies were not in Hebrew, but, you know, studying the Bible, you know, the Old Testament in the Hebrew language was very difficult for me at a young age. And it seemed like the other kids just got it, and I didn't get it. And it was so hard, and I, you know, in like about third grade, I just decided to shut off. I was like, okay, this is not for me. This, you know, I'll do well in secular studies. And I did. You know, I was in math and history and science, whatever we had, you know, whatever science we had in third grade. I did very well, so I didn't have a learning disability. I was tested for disability, but I just couldn't get the Hebrew thing. I could not get the Hebrew. And as a result of that, I started making a lot of trouble. I was the class clown, and the teacher actually told me, she said, you know, Moshe, if you want to make jokes, that's fine. You can be the class clown, but only on the last day of school, not now. So on the last day of school, I, at home, I went in the basement, and I took out a clown costume. And I walked into the classroom on stilts that day. But that was the that was my class clown experience. So basically, from third grade on, I made a decision that when the time comes, I'm going to drop out and run away from school, run away from Hebrew school, because I cannot do this thing. This is just not for me. So I basically sort of wiggled around and somehow got through, you know, middle school. And then for high school, I went to a school out of town, which is sort of common for Orthodox Jews to send, you know, to go to boarding school out of town, like a higher education. So I went to school in ninth grade, and they didn't like me so much, so they asked me to leave. I think that's what you call it. What do you call kicked out? How do you say it? What's the nice way of saying it?
Yeah.
I remember being called to the office. You know, Moshe, we think that you might do better in a different school. You know, it's like, no, this is okay. No, I'll be okay here. Well, no, we really think you should go to a different school.
Right.
So 10th grade, I found some other school, and a little Jewish high school called the Yeshiva. That's the word for Jewish high school, yeshiva. And this is 10th grade, and I was like, oh my God, this is enough. Enough is enough. I got to get out of high school. So with the blessing of my parents, at the ripe age of 16, I dropped out of high school. And my parents were so, so supportive and so, so amazing. And they realized, like, this wasn't for me. And even, you know, even the secular studies, I started to really hate math and algebra. Like, who needs this stuff? And I'll be honest with you, like,
true,
who needs this stuff? I don't know if my kids are gonna listen to this, but like, my son came home with homework last night with the common denominator. You know, this is fractions and fractions. My wife says to me, you know, Moshe, can you help us real with the homework? It's just the common denominator. I was like, oh my gosh, I am the denominator. I was like, no. So, you know, I did not like formal education. I wanted to just go start life. So at the age of 16, I left high school. And very quickly, I got not a GED. I did finish correspondence. And for between the age of 16 and 18, I wasn't a bum. I wasn't like, you know, partying and doing bad things. I had some friends. I had some good times. But I actually was looking for a job. So I got an amazing job flipping burgers. Oh, did I flip them burgers? So I was flipping burgers for like 2 months, and then I saw a job opening in a Jewish day school for working with very developmentally disabled kids. And I always loved people. And I loved having a good time. And I loved, as much as I hated being educated, I loved educating others, helping people. So I applied for the job. I had a job interview. It was great. At the end of the job, the interviewer said, "Okay, so what's your college background like?" I said, "I got to tell you something. I'm actually 16 years old, and I just left 10th grade a few months ago." She said, "Oh." But she liked me so much, so she spoke to her supervisor, and she said, "You know, Moshe," and she called me back a few days later. She said, "Moshe, we're breaking all the rules here, but we like you, and we're going to hire you."
Wow.
So that was like a really cool, really cool thing for me. To have someone believe in me and say that, you know, we're breaking the rules for you. So I ended up teaching in Jewish day school here in Detroit for like 2 years. And then at age of 18, I decided to sort of, you know, revisit my roots and find my place in Judaism. And I decided to book an El Al flight to Israel. So I went to Israel for a gap year, okay? And that gap year turned into a gap decade.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was in the city of Jerusalem, as we say in Jerusalem, or as the Israelis say in English, Jerusalem, or Yerushalayim, or in Arabic, Al-Quds. I was in Jerusalem in a school there, and I had a great time. And with English, you can get by basically anywhere in the world. English, for those of you listening to this podcast, you probably understand English, and you should feel cool for that. I know a lot of you guys want to learn other languages, but if you speak English, you're really cool because you could get around with English anywhere. But I was hanging out in Jerusalem, having a good time, but I sort of felt like a bystander watching everything that was happening, because I didn't really feel like part of part of everything that I could have experienced in Jerusalem, all the happenings, all the parties, all the events. Like Jerusalem is happening. It is like it's a lot going on there always, everywhere. And I sort of felt like I was like watching from the sidelines. And why is that? That's because in Jerusalem, yes, you can get around with English, but really, they speak Hebrew, they speak Arabic, and they speak Yiddish. Mm-hmm. And if you really want to experience life to its fullest, I believe, and this is true, you got to experience through the language of that society. Make sense, Chris?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was just thinking about an article I wrote about why you should learn Danish, because people are saying, well, every Dane speaks great English. Why should I learn the Danish language? And I think one of the biggest reasons is just the connections you can make and then the opportunities you get, which are a lot deeper than just the shallow communication, because language is not just communication. It's also building relationships. And I just think that if you speak in a, let's say, English to people who has it as a second language, you're just not building that deep connection. And I think you'll find that you'll have a very shallow kind of experience in the country, or maybe not in the country, but in a group of people who have that language as a common language. So totally hear you.
No, for sure. Right. Like you and I as language lovers, you know, you speak a bunch of languages. Like, you know, when you speak to someone in his own language, it just goes right to his heart.
Yeah.
It's just the connection just opens right there. The walls just break down.
Yeah, you don't even need to do it well. It's just the kind of gesture that you're trying is a huge difference.
Right. So in the neighborhood I lived in, it's called Mea Sharim. It's a very old, what they call a very right-wing Orthodox community. That's where I was in yeshiva in the postgraduate, post-high school, even though I didn't go to high school. Post-high school, whatever you call it, higher education, post-high school yeshiva. So the main language was of these right-wing Jews was Yiddish. And I figured, okay, I got to learn some Yiddish. So I went to the bookstore and found no books teaching Yiddish. Okay. Why is that? We'll talk about that later. But one Friday night, I was walking to a party. It's called a Tisch. Do you speak German?
Yeah, is it a table or...?
Exactly. Tisch means a table. So there's a certain kind of party. You might want to Google it. I don't know. You look on YouTube. It is amazing. I'm telling you, like I said, Chris, when you have like a beeper for the 3 hour point. Beep, beep, beep. Okay, that means you got 2 minutes to go. It is amazing to see that the way other cultures have a good time, the way they get together, it is amazing. You know, you see the Africans, the Indians, the Jews, the Americans. The Americans not so exciting. Just go to Raven. You know, that's not so exciting. That's not so exciting. But it's amazing to see the way other cultures have a good time and get together. So one Friday night, I was walking to a tish. Now, what is a tish? A table? Yes, I was walking to a table. A tish is a Hasidic gathering where, like, the main Hasidic leader, this is so cool, he sits at one end of the table, and he's the leader of the community, and they have, like, bleachers, and all the members of the community stand on the bleachers, and they have, like, a great time singing and eating, and they pass around food. It's, like, it's awesome. So I was walking to this Hasidic tish, and I was walking to a buddy of mine who spoke some Yiddish, and I said to him, listen, you know, I want to ask you, this is how it all started. I said, how do you say, how's it going in Yiddish? He said, oh, you say, was macht a Yid? Was macht a Yid? I said, was macht Yid? Well, that's a long word. He said, no, it's actually four words. Was macht a Yid? Which literally means, how is a Jew? It's kind of like in America, like you hear sort of like, people say, like, what's up, brother?
Hmm.
Or people of a different, you know, people, you know, African Americans might say, like, you know, what's up, my brother? Whatever, they use a different word, right?
Yeah.
So it's sort of like if this is like our own personal word, you know, what's up, Jew? But, like, if you say that to me, right? It's the same thing with black people. Right? If I would say, hey, what's up, something, you know, they're like, what? You know?
Yeah.
If you say, hey, what's up, Jew boy? Chris, what do you call me? But in Yiddish, you say, was macht ihr? That's how you say it. What's up, you know, like, Jew brother? You know? So that's the first expression I ever learned. So I was walking a few feet down the road. I saw these two Hasidim. And I whip out of my pocket this new expression. I said, was macht ihr? They gave me this funny look. And they kept walking. I was like, wow, they actually understood me, you know? Amazing. And that's how it all started. I learned one word. And then after Sabbath, I went to the store. After that, the Shabbat, after Saturday, I went to the store. I made a big investment in my language learning career, one of the biggest investments I've ever made. I took out 2 shekel, which is the equivalent of about 47 cents. I invested in a little pocket notebook. I might have it somewhere over here. And I wrote down that expression, was macht a Yid? How's a Jew? What's up? So, and then I figured, okay, that's cool. I know this now. Okay, so all I have to do is do it again. Learn another word. So next time I went to the street, I saw a Hasidic Jew. I would ask him, excuse me, can you teach me a word? And then that's how it went. That's how it went. The most important expression I ever learned in Yiddish and any language is how do you say in Yiddish, right?
Yeah, it's very useful.
Yeah, so like in Yiddish, the way you say it is, wie azoi zogt man sidewalk auf Yiddish. And you probably understand some of that, right?
Yeah, sure.
Right. So wie azoi zogt man sidewalk auf Yiddish. And I think the word is tratavar, even though no one says it, which is really comes from French, I think.
Right. Like a stepping something or something.
Yeah. When I would say, you know, wie azoi zogt man iPhone auf Yiddish, they would say, you know, wie azoi, you know, I would say, kennst du mir lernen ein neues Wort auf Yiddish? They would say, was willst du wissen? That's not always works. You know, I'm sure people ask you, you know, can you teach me a word in English? Well, what do you want to know?
Yeah, right? Exactly.
It's like, there's like, I know a bunch of words in English.
Yeah, I can't just randomly pick one for you.
Yeah, it's like I'm a musician, and sometimes like I'll be playing at something. People say, okay, play a song. Okay, well, songs, yeah. We take requests, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's how it started. And that really was the big point of my, you know, my learning. That's how I succeeded, really, was, and this is the message for language learners, and this is still how I do it with other languages. It's, don't have a huge goal. I want to be fluent in the language. That might be nice to have that goal somewhere floating around in your backpack, somewhere in the back burner, but have a goal. I want to have a really small success. The way to succeed in language learning is to get really, really good at having small successes.
Yeah.
And then again.
Totally agree with that. And it's
that's huge, especially, like I said, like my background, not being an educational academic fella, right? Like, that's exactly what I needed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's fascinating. Of course, the topic of the day is Yiddish, but I feel like we just need to close out the Hebrew as well, because you said that you were you're quite useless back in the day. And what happened with that? Did you ever go back and sort of improve that, your knowledge or understanding of it, or what happened there?
Of Hebrew? Yeah, so I'll tell you. So like I said, like I went for a gap year just to spend a year after post-high school.
Right.
Quote, unquote.
And it turns out,
so I want to continue the Yiddish story. I mean, the Yiddish story is still going on now, you know, 14, 15 years later. But just to continue the Yiddish story a drop further, so I was learning all these words. Like, as you know, Chris, like it's not enough just know a bunch of words. You have to actually at some time bring it together with grammar. So I went to the store, and like I said, there's no books, no Yiddish books over there. But I went home one day for Passover one year. That year, my first year, I went home for Passover. And my father, of blessed memory, I was looking through his books, and he had this old book from 1939 called Der Yiddish Lehrer. It was like this old yellow page book. It was about 70 pages, these grammar tables, like, and these lessons that were so important. Like the bear picks up the bucket. Like, when was the last time you saw a bear picking up a bucket?
Yeah.
Is that important?
Never.
So but I was excited about it. I was like, wow, this is amazing. So I got this book, and it actually did help me because I actually had a ton of grammar, a ton of vocabulary. I was able to look at the grammar, and it sort of like fit into place. And like I'm sure you know, and you've heard from other language learners, and you know from yourself, like once you have a ton of words, then and you have exposure to the language, once you start learning grammar, it's actually kind of cool. It's like, oh, that's why they're saying it. Yeah. And that's why you say, was machst du and was macht ihr? Yeah, okay, ich lerne and du lernst. Ja, ich verstehe. Du verstehst. You know, I understand. So it all sort of fits into place. So that was exciting for me. But that was about it. That was the only dictionary there. And then there was this huge, and I went on Amazon in the early days of Amazon. And there was this big old textbook from a little more modern, from like 1959. But also, it was like the standard textbook, like the first lesson. It's like this huge paragraph. Like, are you joking? Like, do you think I can read this and understand it? And it was like this academic Sprach that no one speaks. Like, it made me meshuggah just looking at this thing. So there was no book. So I had to sort of just pick up the grammar on my own with this little old school, little Yiddish lehrer. And that's how I learned grammar. And then later on down the road, I ended up writing the Easy Schmeezy Guide to Yiddish, which just became a huge success. But that was, you know, now I'm taking 2 years into my Israel story, and I was so heavily focused on Yiddish, I was actually ignoring the main language of Israel, which is Hebrew. Right? Yep. So when I was the old age of 21, I married my wonderful wife, Batya, and we got married in the USA. I finished college. I know, I dropped out of high school at 16, worked for 2 years, and I went to school at 18, but somehow I ended up doing college in there. I went back to, we got married in the U.S., and I graduated college, and then a few months later, moved back to Israel, and we moved to a community. There are places in Israel where we're like Hebrew, English, like you could totally get by with. It's sort of like there are places in the U.S. where you have the immigrants, and they have like their own society, like Chinatown, right?
Exactly.
And Detroit, you have Mexican Town, where like you don't really hear English, you know? And there's a place in Michigan called Dearborn. It's actually 5 minutes from my house. Like, it's totally, totally, like, it's only Muslims, not Chaldeans. It's Muslims from the Middle East. And all you hear there is Arabic.
Yeah.
So there are places like that in Israel where there's a place called Beit Shemesh, some of you may have heard of. And, like, the language of the street over there is English. There are places in Jerusalem where the language of the street is English. So there's so many Anglos in there. But where I moved in northern Jerusalem between Pisgat Zev and Ramallah, there was not really any English going on over there. So my wife and I were these newlyweds in this apartment, and with wonderful neighbors, but no neighbors that spoke English. So it's kind of like, we're getting kind of lonely over here. So my landlord actually lived upstairs, and he was a Sephardic Jew. He's actually from Morocco. This guy was so, so cool. I'm telling you, so cool. So I would hang out at his house like many nights, late at night, like until like 12 o'clock, drinking Turkish coffee. And he actually started teaching me Hebrew, and that's basically the same way I learned Yiddish. I invested another like the shekel by that point was like 49 cents. It wasn't 47 cents anymore. So I invested 49 cents in another, and then just started writing down words, and that's how I picked up Hebrew. And that's the story of Hebrew. So yeah, I'm definitely fluent in Hebrew. And I actually also wrote The Easy Shmizi Guide to Hebrew. Great book. great book, and it comes with a lifetime guarantee. That's true. If you ever don't like it, you just give me a call and you take your stinking $9.95 back. Okay.
Perfect.
Yeah. So that's how I got into Hebrew and Yiddish. That's the story of Yiddish. Awesome. And the story goes on, but you know, and after writing before I wrote the book, I started YiddishAcademy.com. YiddishAcademy.com. Which I think if you Google Learn Yiddish Online, I think we're number one, which is pretty cool.
That's awesome. Well, maybe we can get back into the now, I guess, in a second. I just wanted to go back a little bit and talk about the culture a little bit, because as an ignorant outsider and foreigner, sometimes we can get these ideas in our heads about something like a language culture. But how would you describe the... I mean, there are a lot of American listeners of the podcast. I'm sure if we start from there, then we can go from there. But how is it the kind of, how is it being a Yiddish speaker in America? Do you know, and what kind of attitudes do you see in the communities? Is there a big difference, or are they quite integrated? I don't know if that's the right word, but you know, are they? Do they live for themselves, or is it just a part of any other a city? Or can you share some cultural ideas about it for people who have no idea, like myself? Like, I don't think there are many Yiddish speakers in Denmark, if any.
Well, I'll have to move there one day. I'll be the first one.
Oh, yeah.
So that is a loaded, loaded question, and a great question. So just to back up about... about maybe like, you know, 2,000 years, the Jews, wherever they went, they always had their own language. The Jews are a very close-knit community, Jews take care of each other, and even Jews from around the world, like, will reach out to Jews who they don't know for help. I'm not trying to, you know, get any converts over here. As a matter of fact, Judaism, that we do not... We do not look for converts. We don't go knocking on your doors. We're here to save you. Like, being a Jew is not hard, and you know, history has shown that the world does not love us so much. You know, we've been thrown out of a few countries. So yeah, I'm not trying to get any volunteers to join me over here. But the Jews take care of themselves, very close knit, and therefore, the Jews have always had their own language. You know, starting with Hebrew. I mean, no, that's up for debate whether it was Hebrew or maybe something else. But you know, let's say Hebrew. And even when it wasn't their own language, the Jews formed their own language out of the national language. So even in Egypt, there was research that shows when the Jews were enslaved in Egypt, you know, maybe 3,000 years ago. I'm a Yiddish guy, not a historian. In Egypt, the Jews had their own sort of, you know, pidgin or their own, whatever you call it. Their own jargon of Egyptian. And when the Jews were in, when they went into, after the first destruction of the first temple, the Jews in Jerusalem, they went to exile in Babylon, and they started speaking, well, they didn't start, they spoke Aramaic, but they had Judeo-Aramaic, their own Aramaic.
Hmm.
Okay? You know, mixed in, and you might ask, what were they mixing in? Like, sugar, salt? I'll tell you what they mixed in a second. This is a big secret. And you on the podcast get to hear all about this. This is just so cool what I'm going to tell you. So, and the Jews, then they, you know, let's fast forward maybe 1,000 years. That was a quick fast forward. The Jews spoke, you know, many Jews spoke Arabic. Maimonides, have you heard of Maimonides?
No.
It's okay. He was one of the great Jewish philosophers. He was a famous doctor. He wrote many works on early medicine and the Jewish law. But Maimonides, all of his works besides one were written in Judeo-Arabic, okay? What is Judeo-Arabic? Judeo-Arabic was the spoken Arabic, but mixed in with this other stuff, which I'll tell you about in a minute, the secret sauce. And then the Jews were in Spain, and they spoke Spanish. But you know what? After a little while, they started mixing it in with some other stuff, which turned into Ladino. And the Jews around 1,000 years ago also Many Jews moved around the Rhine River in Deutschland, in Germany, and they started picking up Yiddish, started picking up German, but you know what? They mixed in some of their own stuff, and it turned into, Chris?
Yiddish.
Yiddish, that's right. Very good. So what I'm telling you is that wherever the Jews went, they mixed in some of their own stuff and made their own language. Sometimes that language turned into a formal language with grammar, and maybe there might even be some sort of authority on the language. But many times language sort of just, you know, like I'm of the opinion that every language is a living language. And the people who own the language are those that speak it. The people who own the language are not the people in the university right. who write the textbook. No, that's not how you say it. It says it like this. No. You know who decides? The people who speak the language. They have the right to decide. Yeah. Catch my drift?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the old question of, is there such a thing as correct language when mm-hmm. it, in fact, it's changing all the time? So that also puts pressure on learners, because if the people who speak it natively don't speak as it says in the textbook, then can you really fault a learner for not speaking quote-unquote correctly? And of course, some languages develop faster than others, but it's difficult to produce a book or materials that are going to last for a long time because the language just develops and changes. So yeah, I see that for sure as well.
Right. So I'm telling you about these languages, you know, Judeo-Aramaic, Judeo-Arabic, Judeo-German, which, you know, some call it Yiddish, Judeo-German. And there's even now in the U.S., there's a language called Yeshivish. So you might ask me, am I a polyglot? And I might ask you, I'm not sure. But I definitely, you know, have knowledge, I'm fluent in, like, you know, four languages. You know, I don't speak, I'm definitely polyliterate, that's for sure. But one language I speak fluently is a language called Yeshivish. Is it a language? Is it a pigeon? Is it a jargon? What is it? So what is it first? Yeshivish is a language. It's a dialect of, I don't know what it is. It's English spoken in the U.S. and the U.K. By Orthodox Jews, primarily men, speak Yeshivish. And it's a language of the, like, people who've gone to higher Jewish academies, you know, for higher education. So it's like a very unique language that people pick up in when they're studying a higher level of Jewish education.
Huh.
It is very cool.
That's very interesting. I've never heard of that before.
It is amazing. Like that we're seeing this, you know, the Jews have only been in the U.S. for such a short period of time. I mean, like, there are Jews who've been here for 200 years, but if you ask anyone in the U.S., you know, where you're from, so, you know, I'm from the U.S. Where about your parents? Also the U.S. Your grandparents? Oh, Germany. You know, they came after the Holocaust. They survived the war. Or they didn't survive, you know, whatever it was. But, like, I'm unique when I say that all of my grandparents were born in the U.S.
Right.
And my family came here, you know, about 100 years ago from Russia. Either being persecuted or just they were somehow able to flee Russia. Like I said, we've had a tough time, you know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
And for sure.
So we've been here for such a short period of time, and we've already developed. I can't say the whole. It's like a very, very, very small percentage of the Jewish people in the U.S. I would say maybe as little as 1% of the Jewish people in the U.S. I don't know how many people are here, but there are communities of, let's say, you know, 30,000-40,000 people, maybe, you know, in Brooklyn and in Lakewood, New Jersey. And maybe another 40,000 in Jerusalem, and maybe another 50,000 in Britain. And you know, maybe 10,000 in Australia. These pockets of Anglos, you know, Orthodox Jews who speak this Yeshivish. So it's just amazing that, you know, whether it's Australia, the UK, all these Jews who are speaking English have been doing it for probably around 100 years, not more than that, right?
Right.
And there's already some sort of, you know, jargon that they've built up. And it's
very interesting.
It's very interesting.
What
and right now, the Yeshivish thing I'm telling you about in the U.S. is not formal at all. There is no, it's very, very flexible. And you know what? That's how Yiddish started 1,000 years ago.
Right.
It was only until many years later that, you know, it had a formal grammar. And I don't think that this yeshivish thing, this, you know, this American America English or whatever you call it, I don't think it's going to turn into a formal language. But so what is this main ingredient I'm telling you about? What is this special ingredient that all these languages have had? What made it a Jewish language? Right. So the answer is that these languages may have been like 80%, you know, the native language, you know, Aramaic or Arabic, and 10% Hebrew, 7% Aramaic, and 3% some other something, and 100% fun and happiness and love. So the Jews, they mixed in these words from their own like books, you know, their books of the Torah, the Old Testament. They took expressions from over there and would mix it in to the native language and make it their own, which is really cool. Yeah, and, you know, sure. Expressions from the Talmud, which is the main code of Jewish law, and mix it in into the language. So, for example, right, you might want to know, okay, Moshe, so give me an example, right?
Yeah, I need some more examples. We need to hear, like, what is this new, fascinating, well, almost dialect, I guess you can call it, that you're talking of. Like, what kind of, how much is it? Because when you say Yiddish, you would say it sounds a lot like German with some of these secret ingredients you mentioned. Well, not so secret anymore now that you've revealed them, but, you know, it's mostly, it sounds like German with these ingredients. So I presume that this new one would be sound a lot like English, but have these, let's say, inspiration from other the other languages.
Yeah. So, you know, it's just like so interesting. There's so many examples, and in like, for example, in Yiddish, what's the word for in German for book? Buch, right?
Yeah, Buch.
Buch. So the word, we have the word Buch, and but the word for if it's like, so in Yiddish we'll say, you know, ich hab geschrieben a Buch, right? Ich hab geschrieben a Buch. I wrote a book.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I wrote a book, but if I'm referring to a book of Judaism, like a prayer book, I will not say Buch. I will say Sefer, which is the Hebrew word for book.
Huh.
You get this? If I'm talking about, this is amazing. And if I'm talking, so like if it's a word that has a religious significance, I might use a Hebrew word for it.
Huh, that's interesting.
Hold on a second. My clean lady is just walking in. She's a wonderful, wonderful lady. Hola, Safira. ¿Cómo estás, amiga mía?
Bien, gracias.
Bienvenido a mi casa.
Gracias.
Okay. No molestas, no molestas, no molestas, siempre. Okay. Nunca. Okay. So, I love languages. Okay. So, if the word has a religious significance, then it might take on a different word. So, like a word for glass, give me a glass of water, gib mir ein Glas Wasser. Right. You understand that, right?
Yeah.
Right. However, if it's a, if the cup I'm talking about is a cup used for a religious service, sometimes we have a special cup of wine on Saturday, then I'm not going to use the word glaz, because this is a cup that has a religious significance. I'll use the word becher. Mm-hmm. I don't know where the word becher comes from.
I think it exists as well, actually. But it's used about the paper cups, you know, like the college red and blue cups.
Hmm.
Interesting. Yeah. Related to beaker, I guess, somehow. But in Danish it's bæger,
B-A-G-E-R.
So definitely understand that too.
Right. And for words like let's say you tell me something outlandish. I'm like, Chris, what are you talking about? Are you crazy, right? So and I'm not going to say it to you because you're a nice guy, but I would never say this thing. That's disrespectful. But in Yiddish, you might say, mehechatesi. And mehechatesi, I could say, you know, in Yiddish, you know, was meinst du? What do you mean? Or, but I could say, bist du meshuga? Are you meshuga? Meshuga means crazy. The word is actually in the Oxford Dictionary. There's like many Yiddish words that have snuck their way into English too.
Yeah, I've heard some of them. Yeah.
Yeah. So bist du meshuga? Meshuga is a Hebrew word for crazy. and it's it means like a person has gone mad, and the word is in the prophets that use the word. So in Yiddish, we'll use that word.
Right.
Just the meshuga. And sometimes we use the word meshugavtait, which means like dead crazy. Right?
Yeah, that's quite next level.
Yeah. But what's interesting, the word meshugavtait, toit is Yiddish or German also for dead. I'm not sure in German, but so it's like you take a Hebrew word and put it together with a German word. So you have a compound word with from two different languages. So, so that, like, if I want to say expression like, "Where are you coming from?" Like, "Mehechatesi," where are you coming from? Who told you that? So I wouldn't say "From wann kommst du." I would use the Aramaic expression, which is, you know, came, you know, 600-700 years before Yiddish showed up. The expression "Mehechatesi" means "From where are you coming from?" Mehechatesi.
Right.
And now listen to this. Now some people in the U.S. who speak Yeshivish. Wait, did I say Mecha freaking Tasty? So it's just amazing. That's like, you wouldn't, that's not a very respectable way to, you know, say like, what the heck are you talking about? You know, Was redst du? Narishkeit. You're speaking Narishkeit, which is like, Nar is the Hebrew word for fool or childish, and kite is actually a German suffix.
Right.
So Narishkeit. It's like, it's almost like I'm saying, you're speaking fool kite. It sounds kind of funny, but like that's what Yiddish is. Like, we'll take a word in Hebrew or a different, you know, a word from Aramaic and give it a German, you know, Germanized suffix, a Yiddishized suffix. You got it?
Right.
So that's...
It's fascinating. Little,
yeah.
It almost reminds me of the Amish, what do they call it? They also call it Dutch. They might call it Deutsch, but I'm not sure if they mean Dutch or Deutschland, Deutsch. But it's similar in that they have this, for instance, Pennsylvania Dutch, which is basically like, you know, it sounds like some amalgamation of Dutch, German, and lots of English. So I thought it was it's a similar linguistic phenomenon, I'm sure, and it fascinates me a lot. Actually, I almost wanted to learn it, but then I was like, yeah, what am I going to use that for? You know, reality set in.
I don't know if you can get any Amish people on your podcast either. I don't know if they'll be interested in the interview.
No, I'd probably have to like print out the transcript and then send it by mail to them. But no, not a huge market for the actual Fluency podcast as far as I know, but it just reminded me so much of it. They would say something like es war eine weiße Maschine, so it's saying weiß is from German and then Maschine is from English, or Russian even, I guess, could be, it's the same word. But it's just interesting to see how of that assimilation almost happens, where you take the best of both worlds, or the cool things in both worlds. And actually, this is also groundbreaking. Possibly something similar is happening in Danish, where Danish people, especially young people, when they speak together, people are starting to prefer the English words instead of perfectly usable Danish words. So for instance, if a young person if somebody steps on your toe in the bus, they might say sorry here, you know, because that sorry is just easier, I guess. It's not as emotional.
Right, and it can also be that when you say that word sorry, it drives the point home clearer than the Danish word.
Yeah, in Danish you would
say... It expresses the point better.
Yeah, in Danish you would say it's similar as in German. What they say, I forgot, how do you say it, sorry?
Say what?
In German, or we try Yiddish, how do you say sorry?
Entschuldigt.
Yes, exactly, yes. So that's the same in Danish. And I just think that sorry just hits it harder. But I don't think that the Danish assimilation has been studied. And of course, it's also a more recent thing. But it just shows you the power of the globalized community we live in, I suppose, and the shifts that happen. But watch this space. Maybe that'll be my PhD dissertation in 50 years or something, when I'm done being out of the academic world. Right.
But I think the point that you're saying is very important, and that, you know, in terms of, you know who owns the language, but the people who speak the language, you know, they whether they own it or not, or whether, you know, some professors with bow ties like it or not, they will, the people will choose the way they want to express something.
Exactly.
And even in Israel, and you see this in every culture, if there's a word that expresses it better, then they'll take that, we'll take that word. Like, you have a lot of, like, you know, dirty words or slang for different expressions that you'll find in from English. Like, a lot of four-letter words are used in other countries.
Right.
And you know, the four-letter words as a whole, that's a podcast of its own. It's amazing. Like, who says this is a bad word? Right. And why do people use them? You know? I mean, the answer is because, like, it's just amazing. You know, I can just say one word and that expresses exactly how I feel, you know?
Yeah. And do you think also there's something to the idea that loan words have less emotional meaning? Like, for instance, if an English-speaking American, if you went up and said the F word to him or her, he would be quite taken aback because that's strong language, right? But if you're right. If you're in Denmark, for instance, and not kidding, like primetime television, 7:30 p.m., the host of the TV show says it, and it's not censored.
Are you serious?
I am 100% serious.
That's so funny. And
it's just like, you know,
hey everyone, are you doing?
Yeah, it's like, and then I think about myself and I'm like, it is actually easier for me to swear in English than it is in Danish. So there must be some.
Hey, Chris, keep this clean. My kids are going to listen to this, okay?
Yeah, sure.
I'm American, okay?
Yeah, it's fair. Yeah. Well, I think the show should be clear, anyways. I once had an idea that swearing would enhance certain points, but then I got a few emails saying that they thought they brought it down instead. So I'm kind of conforming, but if you talk to me in real life, I swear I'll put in a swear word once in a while if it's not being recorded and there are no kids around.
You should have a podcast, though, about, you know, insults and four-letter words in different cultures. That would be cool. All
right.
But so what I'm getting with this, what I got, this little tangent about the four-letter words, and sometimes through, like, one word, which really means something else, like, you know, there's different words, like, different four letters we have are really mean different things. But if you just pull it out at the right time, it just gets the point across.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you could say something off, you know? I could just say get lost, or I could say blank off, you know?
Yeah.
So in Hebrew, there are words, like, there are some Arabic words that sort of got mixed in. And even the modern Hebrew also is very, very different than the biblical Hebrew. It's sort of like, it's the same thing as all these Jewish languages, 80%. It's actually just different, though. It's like 80% biblical Hebrew and 20%, you know, Arabic, French, Russian, German, like a bunch of cool stuff in there. And actually, my Easy Schmeezy Guide to Hebrew, I have some, like, lists of words in the back of, you know, the Arabic influence, the English influence, and the Yiddish influence in Hebrew. So, like, for example, there's a word in, like, you know, in the U.S. we say, what a bummer, yeah?
Mm.
Do you say that in Denmark?
No, I don't think so.
But it means, you know what a bummer is, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Like, yeah. So, like, in Hebrew, there might be a way to say it, but they say "ez a basa," and "basa" is Arabic for, like, this situation stinks.
Right. Yeah?
Like, and, you know, why did I say it in Arabic? Just say it in Hebrew. You know, the answer, you know, we could use say it in Hebrew, but just the way the Arabs say it, like, basa explains the situation. Did you say that one word and it's crystal clear what's going on? This stinks. Oh my gosh, this could not be worse. It's a basa.
It's a wonderful world, isn't it? Where you can, like, if you have some sort of situation that you need to describe, which communication is, I've learned in my, I think it was, what was it? Linguistics 101 that I took a half a semester of, where we were told that, you know, the point of language is really to convert complex thought into convey complex thought, which isn't really that conveyable. So any time that a human person can, well, that's the most of the people we have data from, but any time a person can use something in they're aware of exists and they know the other person is aware of it, that conveys that thought clearer, then they will use it. And I guess that it's kind of a survival of the fittest in the languages, because the words that are actually being used, aka the, let's say, the popular ones, they're kind of going into mainstream, and then the words that I never use, which are maybe longer, or maybe they're vague or something, they just kind of fall into disuse, and then they become archaic at some point. Like, there are lots of words in all languages that where you know what it means, but you're like, yeah, nobody would say that since like 1955, you know. So yeah, that's really fascinating.
Yeah, and that's amazing what, like you said about you know, languages is all about like conveying it in the clearest way. And that's like really, it's really, it's simple, but it's very deep. Like, yeah, that's why we're talking, to convey things. No, but like, let's try to, when I speak to you, Chris, I want to speak to you in a way that you're just going to get the point, like really clearly.
Right.
And Yiddish is so filled with, you know, expressions and proverbs and insults that could, you know, the way they express it, because they'll take a word from the Bible or a word from the Talmud or an old word. They'll say one word. And that expresses a point, you know, better than, you know, three paragraphs.
Exactly.
I'll just give you a quick example. There's an insult, which you say, avaya zasa. Can you say that, Chris? Avaya zasa?
Avaya zasa?
Beautiful, yeah. So what is avaya zasa? Like, if I'm talking about someone, I want to say, this guy is just, what a fool. This is like... I could tell you, I could talk to you for like 3 minutes about why this guy's a fool, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he just did such a, like, he did not take it, you know, he was a fool, Vyazasa. So who was Vyazasa? Who was this famous person, Vyazasa? And if I want to tell you, like, this guy is just an idiot, Vyazasa, right? who was this famous guy who went down in history that we now use his name to, like, insult people, Vyazasa, right?
Yeah.
So Vyazasa, there's a story, Another story of when the Jews were almost killed. King Aser, I think he's saying English. In Hebrew, it's Ahasuerus, Aseris or something. And there was, this is in Persia, and there was the bad guy Haman. They were going to kill all the Jews. This is the Purim story. And there's actually a Megillah written about it. That's where the expression comes, the whole Megillah. There's a scroll, one of the Jewish books written about this, in the Jewish history. And the Jews were going to be destroyed. There's a whole story. And then the bad guy who wanted to kill the Jews, the king decreed that he and his 10 sons be hung. So they hung Haman, the bad guy, and his 10 sons one by one. And the last guy who was hung, his name was Vyazasa. So like the question is, like, why did this fool sit around? He saw the nine brothers being hung. The guy should have ran for his life. He just said, oh, there's one of them. And then he was next. What an idiot. The guy should have ran away. Now, of course, he was in shackles, I'm sure, you know. But Vyazasa. So that's Vyazasa.
Yeah, I've seen that before, where, well, I can't think of the example right now, but I'm sure there are examples in other languages where either a famous name or a person is used as a way to, like, insult people, or at least sometimes you know, affectionately so. But it's an interesting addition to language that you can use these names, which is essentially a concept, and people just translate it directly. You know, I thought that was kind of interesting.
Right. And even, you know, it's not a new concept. Even in the Bible, which is written, you know, 3,000 years ago or something like that, 3,000, the Old Testament, there's an expression over there about one of the kings. His name was Nimrod, and he was a tremendous hunter. And the Bible says that people would say, you know, he's as strong as Nimrod.
Right.
And like that's an expression. So that's a good way. He's a Nimrod. Wow, that's cool. Better to be a Nimrod than a Vyazasa.
Yeah, Herculean strength is sometimes used as a modifier, at least. And it also refers back to ancient stories. So it's fascinating. One thing I do want to just get into here before we reach the three-hour mark is more in terms of... Actually, just a question: like, why should anyone learn Yiddish? Let's assume the people who actually consider this question would be people who don't have any heritage, or they're not in a community where Yiddish is all around them. Why should they take the time to learn Yiddish? What are some of the, if you had to give like the elevator pitch, you know, the 30-second sales pitch for learning Yiddish, what would that be?
So I would say, because if you want to be friends with Moshe Sherrod, then. I am a very cool guy, and if you want to really get to know me on a deeper level, darfst du reden Yiddish. Darfst learn in Yiddish. Ashena Yiddish, yeah.
Right.
No, that's the main reason. There are other reasons too. I'll get into those in a second. So that is an interesting question. And I have this website, like I said, yiddishacademy.com, and we get so many interesting emails. But really, I'm a good person to ask that question to, because people come to me to learn Yiddish, either one-on-one. I don't really have so many, you know, private students anymore. I'm pretty busy with different stuff. But people come to me one-on-one or through my books. So who are the people who are coming to me, right? And like, why are they coming to me?
Right.
So I have the answer for you, because I get these emails, a lot of emails. Like I said, we're number one on Google, which also tells you something. Like, our site is not so beautiful, okay? And we are number one on Google, which is wonderful. But it wasn't so hard, because we made the website like 8 years ago, and there's not much out there to learn Yiddish, which tells you something also about it. Who wants to learn Yiddish? And I'm just going to be honest, like, I am not a millionaire for my website. I became a millionaire. That's not how I became rich. Yeah?
Right.
Like, I sell a course over there, but when we definitely make sales every month, like a nice little number of sales, but it's not like we don't make 100 sales a month. And we're like the only place online. So there is not a huge interest in Yiddish. And the reason is, I'll tell you why people should learn it and why it's really cool. But it's sort of like, and I do think Yiddish is not, the number is decreasing of, you know, Yiddish speakers. And I could talk about statistics of numbers, you know, maybe if you're interested later. But the interest of Yiddish is decreasing. The people who come to our website, a lot of them are Jewish people who very distant from, being practicing Jews, but they want to connect with Jewish heritage. Or maybe it's someone who they found out that her boyfriend's Jewish, so she wants to understand the Judaism on a deeper level. And really, that's like what Yiddish is. Like, Yiddish, like I told you, like, Yiddish has these expressions, and it's so rich with expressions, and that if you learn Yiddish, it really will tell you so much. If you learn Yiddish, you'll learn more about the Jewish people than you will by, you know, taking, you know, studying Jewish history. Mm-hmm. You know, so why learn Yiddish? So we had these people coming to us. I once had a German Christian come to us, very interesting. He said, you know, he wants to learn Yiddish very well. I said, so tell me, why do you want to learn Yiddish so well? So he emailed me back. He said, well, he wants to, first of all, he just explained how well he wants to know it. He said he wants to know it so well that he can actually read the Talmud in Yiddish. So he was a little disappointed when I told him the Talmud was actually written in Aramaic 600 years before Yiddish came on the scene. But he's like, oh, oof.
Oops.
So why learn Yiddish? Let's say you're not Jewish. Chris, I'm assuming by your name, Chris, that you're not Jewish.
No. Okay?
Even though that famous Jewish guy's name was Christ, yeah.
that's a good point.
Yeah, he was a pretty famous Jew, one of the most famous Jews, yeah.
Exactly.
But why learn Yiddish? So there's like a lot of different angles. If you want to get into Hebrew and you already know German or something like that, Yiddish might be an amazing option for you, like an amazing option, because Yiddish uses the Hebrew characters, okay? The Hebrew alphabet, the alphabet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey. So if you know German or have like a simple understanding of German, then Hebrew is a great way to get into the language. I mean, Yiddish is a great way because you know German, you'll already get the grammar and like tons of the words, and all you have to do is learn the alphabet. So once you know that, you'll get comfortable with the alphabet, then you can use it as a way to get into Hebrew. I was like, hey, Dan. So that's a great way to get into Hebrew. And also, if you know Hebrew, or if you are Muslim, or if you speak Arabic, or if you're Chaldean and you might know Arabic, then the Hebrew alphabet will be easier for you to learn. And, you know, you can learn Yiddish, and that's a great way to get into, it'll be easier for you because you already know Arabic, which is similar to Hebrew.
Right.
So it's sort of like a segue to different kind of different languages. But also, if you want to study a people and you really want to understand like the Jews are a very unique people. Like I said, they've been thrown out of so many countries, been persecuted. And even like, you know, not long ago, 6 million Jews were mass murdered in a period of 4 years, which is crazy.
Right.
Like World War II, that, like, I know people still who, like, I have a neighbor who has numbers on his arm, who's a survivor of the Holocaust. Like, we've been through a lot. And I do think that part of the secret of the Jewish survival is being close-knit. And not that we have our own language, but part of having that language is sort of a sign of our, will to survive and stay together.
Right.
And when you see, like, a language, when you learn Yiddish, and even if you just invest a few months in it, so this is something I want to learn more. You'll find something Yiddish that you find in no other language. You know, the way that it's like I said, it's the same thing we've done with other languages, but this is like the only one that's really, survived. There's no more Ladino. There's no more Judeo-Arabic. There's no more Judeo. No one speaks Judeo-Aramaic. This is the only one. It's been around for 1,000 years. There's been hundreds of thousands of books written in Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
Jews love to read. Jews love education. There's so much poetry, so many plays, so much culture in the language. So it will tell you a lot about a people and I think the will and the stubbornness to survive and the stubbornness to say, no, it's okay, we got thrown out. We're moving to a different country and we're gonna keep going. So I think it's, besides, the language, like I said, it's a segue to German, it's a segue to Hebrew, it's a segue to Arabic. It's really cool. But, in terms of culture and history, you will learn a ton, yeah.
Right. One thing that you said earlier was that, you've said it a few times, is that the culture of the community is very close-knit in modern times. Does that mean that if somebody like me were to learn Yiddish to a pretty good level, would I have trouble sort of engaging in that culture? Like if I found a Yiddish-speaking area somewhere in the U.S. and I went on holiday and I just went up to people and say, how are you? Would they be sort of cold towards foreigners like that, or would I be embraced like an honorary member?
Oh, I love this question. This is great. So, Chris, if you see me walking down the street, I will always give you a big bear hug, okay? So who speaks Yiddish? There are basically two communities that speak Yiddish, okay? There are the what you might call the right-wing Orthodox. And again, there are most right-wing Orthodox, Jews in the U.S. do not speak Yiddish. But it's mostly the Hasidic communities. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Hasidim, but the Hasidic communities from Poland and Hungary, they speak Yiddish. And then there are leftists, Jews who are not really affiliated with, they don't practice Judaism, but they sort of practice Jewish culture. So the Judaism for them is like a cultural thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they speak Yiddish and they study it, and that's why there's a revival in the universities. It's not from the Hasidic Orthodox Jews, it's from the, sort of the academic and the Jewish cultural communities. So the answer is, who will give you the bear hug, okay? I'll give you one. And the Hasidic communities will not be welcoming or interested in people learning the language and trying to join them, because really for them, the language is so important. It's part of what keeps them together.
Hmm.
So, and it's part of what shelters them. It's sort of an insular community. It shelters them from the world. And part of the being sheltered from the world is because, it hasn't been very good when we got too involved in different cultures.
Sure.
It didn't turn out very well,
No, I understand.
Which
understand.
Is a whole different discussion. So, but the communities of people who are like the Jewish cultural communities, who, like I said, don't necessarily practice Jewish law, but love Jewish culture, they will be very welcoming, very excited about people learning Yiddish. That is the answer.
Well, that's good. That's good because obviously we have to keep it real that even if somebody's sitting out there saying, "Wow, this language sounds amazing. I love history, and I'd love to learn this language," and it's just to say that what you're saying is basically don't expect to be welcomed as an honorary member of the community in every community in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Well, right. It was like in my story when I was walking to that party Friday night with the Tish. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's like, that's why I wanted to clarify because I wasn't sure.
Yeah, but listen to this. Well, even when I walked there and I said my first expression to this guy, he looked at me and kept walking. Yeah. No, I'm serious.
Yeah.
And that's because I was very different, Like, I looked like an American kid. I looked very different dress. And, like, this is their special language. This is, like, our special code,
right.
You know?
Yeah, and you don't want to seem like you're trying to pretend to be something you're not, or, I'm not speaking for myself, but, or any kind of cultural appropriation or even mockery, as I guess sometimes you can do if you speak it really poorly and you just randomly shout things you've learned at people, they might take it as a, what is this kid doing? You know, I mean, why is he speaking our beloved language or butchering it? You know, there might not be a lot of patience for that. I don't know. But it's good to talk about since this is a Yiddish episode. So I thought I'd bring it up.
Yeah.
Cool. And you sold
it. Well said, Chris. Well,
you sold it. Well, I don't know. There is this another thing I was thinking about is how, I don't know, the interaction with German is kind of interesting, I think, because as somebody who speaks German, I can pretty accurately understand probably most of Yiddish. There'll be words once in a while where I'm like, what the fuck does that mean? I mean, what the F does that mean?
Yeah, that's right.
There you go. A little slip there. But on the other hand, that seems to make it harder to learn because you're constantly thinking, like, are you using the German word here or the Yiddish word here in the sentence? Is there, you know what I mean? It's like interference. And I don't know if you have any tips on that that account. I don't know if you...
So you're saying, like, basically, if a German speaker would go learn Yiddish, how would you sort of, you know, decipher what is Yiddish and what is German?
Yeah, how do you separate in your head? Like, this is perhaps more of a philosophical question because it's not unique to Yiddish or other languages where it also happens.
Right, no, but it is a unique question because it's like a similar, it's so similar.
Yeah, it's so similar. And also another question, a bonus question is, if I go to, let's say, the welcoming group that we mentioned before, the sort of cultural Jews, and I speak Hochdeutsch, would they understand me? And if so, would that be appreciated or would they just instantly switch to English?
They probably would think it's cool. I would think it's cool.
Right.
You know, that's really where Yiddish comes from, the Hochdeutsch. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's so similar. It's really funny.
Yeah. So I actually want to speak a little Yiddish to you right now and see how much you understand, okay?
Okay.
I think you told me I'm getting paid $30,000 for this podcast. So if you can guess what I'm saying, we'll knock it down to 20, okay?
There's a big cash prize.
Yeah. Okay, you'll save yourself $20,000. So I got a guten tag. And I could speak Yiddish in a way that's more, I could speak it in many different dialects, and I could speak it in a way that, you know, I could speak it in a way that the Yiddish culture community will not understand, and they can speak it in a way, it's really, there's a lot going on here. So I'll start speaking in a more parv way. Parv is a Yiddish word, it's actually, which means more neutral. Guten Tag, Chris. Mein Name is, my heißt Moshe Sherazin, und ich wohne in America, ich wohne in a kleine Stadt, was heißt, Detroit, Michigan. Und ich habe sehr lieb reden Jiddisch und ich habe nicht nur lieb reden Jiddisch, ich habe lieb andere Sprachen euch. Ich red Hebrew, ich lerne jetzt Arabisch und ich habe lieb nicht nur die jiddische Kultur, ich habe lieb alle Kulturen von der Welt. Und ich danke euch sehr, also hast mich eingeladen zu sein auf der Podcast. Heinz, es ist ein größeres Schuss. Dank.
That's great. Yeah, I understood all of that. And just a little observation, because I haven't heard a lot of Yiddish in my life, I have to be honest. It sounds a lot like Dutch to me now, suddenly. You know, kind of like a Dutch with German words, which is interesting. Because it's more singy than I feel like German often is. You know, German can often be a little bit sort of very rigid. Whereas I thought when you were speaking, you had a very nice melody to it. But yeah, for the people who don't speak German or Yiddish, I'll just quickly transcribe. You said that your name is Moshe and you live in Detroit. And you like to learn languages. You like Yiddish. Did you say you like to learn Yiddish or did you say you just like it in general?
I forgot.
It was a long talk. But and then of course you have eingeladen, which is the same word in German, so invite.
Invite. Yeah.
And gewaltig, or however you say it.
That's right. Very good. Gewaltig. Gewaltig.
Gewaltig.
You know, another word for gewaltig is similar. It's actually meuridic, which is interesting because meure is a Hebrew word with a German suffix. You know, a lot of it. It's amazing.
Really, yeah, gewaltig is also in I don't remember the German one, but it's in Danish as well. So I don't know if there's some cross influence here somewhere, but that's making it easier for me. I wonder how fast I could learn Yiddish. I mean, that would be an interesting experiment. Because it's so similar. It's kind of like Swedish and Danish almost, German and Yiddish. So that's definitely interesting. But I think the problem would be that I'll probably try and speak German with a different accent, and then I'm not going to be sure when to use other words. Like you said,
yeah, that would be tricky.
Do you remember what you said first? You said something like I understood it from context, but I didn't actually understand the word. Was it? You said live in. You say was it wohnen?
Ich wohne.
Yeah, that's the same. And then you said something like learn a language.
Ich wohne in ich hab lieb lernen Sprachen.
We have to rewind the tape, but there was a word like in the middle that you said a few times that I didn't understand the word. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was an adjective or something at the end, and I just.
Aber von der Kontext hast verstanden, was ich habe gemeint.
Yeah. Herbig. I don't know. But yeah, super interesting, and I'm glad to feature languages like Yiddish on the podcast to kind of show the world that it's not just people learning Spanish and French all the time. You know, that's part of it too, but also to kind of give the spotlight of the week or month to show that there were other opportunities. And I'm sure that, I mean, we talked about how some of the culture might not be super welcoming to you speaking their language, and it's not like you're going to be instantly accepted as a honorary member. But on the other hand, you also have to remember that if you do take up Yiddish as a non-Jew, you also get a skill that not many non-Jews have. So you get a different perspective on the world, and you have a skill that, I mean, kind of sometimes feels like a superpower, right? I mean, you must feel that sometimes where you have your things that, let's say, non-Jewish Americans have no idea about that even exist. So I think learning any language, you can use that argument, and you know, if you're going to learn something out of the ordinary, why not Yiddish?
That's what I would add. It's also good if you want to work. There is one industry that if you want to really rock that into like work in the industry, you got to speak Yiddish. That's actually kind of cool. If you want to work in like the real upper class diamond industry in the United States.
Wow.
Yeah. It's
kind of. And,
in Manhattan, Goldstein and Schwartz, yeah,
whatever it's called,
Cutters at Diamond.
Yeah,
no, if you want to work in Manhattan in the Diamond District, you really should know Yiddish.
All right, maybe you can get some good deals somewhere also.
Yeah, yeah.
If you can do the haggling in Yiddish.
Exactly.
But anyway, Moshe, I've had a great time hearing about new things, and I think that you kept it quite. You know, you told it in the form of story instead of just reciting facts. And what I would say to people who want more information, you know, this static information, you can go onto Wikipedia and read. I don't think that's super interesting to sit and listen to for too long, you know. So I appreciate that you took that kind of personal angle and related it to what the society is today and what's happened, instead of just saying, well, there are 2 million speakers and there are 197,000 in the US, and I don't know if these numbers are correct or anything, but you know what I mean. It's like, if you want facts, you can go onto Wikipedia, and if you want stories, you can come to the actual Fluency podcast. So thank you.
If you really want to know what it's really about, you gotta learn Yiddish.
Yeah, oh yeah, of course. If you want to know how it really is, then you know, convert and learn Hebrew or Yiddish and go to Israel, I guess. But that's quite a commitment, I would say.
Yeah. Anyway, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming. And just where can people find you? And
So the best way to get started is my book, The Easy Shmeezy Guide to Yiddish, which is easy, and shmeezy is S-H-M-E-E-Z-Y, Guide to Yiddish. You can Google it or get it on Amazon. And if you really need anything at all, any questions about Yiddish, please, I'm not a salesman. I'm not trying to sell you a course or books. I don't care about selling you anything. Please go to YiddishAcademy.com and contact us. Anything you need, translation or, you know, whatever you need, just please reach out, okay?
Definitely.
Yes.
Go for it. And I guess all there is left is to say, I don't know, viel Glück. Viel
Glück. Sei gesund. Sei gesund, mein teurer Freund. Sei gesund, mein Chaver.
Yeah, stay healthy. Sei gesund, mein Freund. And I hope to talk to you soon. And if I ever attack Yiddish, you know, I will definitely, I'll definitely come by.
Yes, definitely. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Actual Fluency Podcast.